Welcome back to the latest edition of You, Me and Web3. It's great to have you along with us. This is the podcast brought to you by the Web3 tech company Forge and hosted by me, Tom McDermott. I'm sure you know the drill by now, but this is where we discuss all things Web3, metaverse, NFTs, but without the jargon you may have heard elsewhere. Today, it's a real pleasure to welcome Loretta Chen to the podcast. And Loretta, before we get going in our usual fashion, can you just give us all the background to how the name of the company you founded came about?
Well, a great question. Are we already live? So it's Smörbla, and Smörbla is actually a composite of two Swedish words, sma for small, bla for furniture, because we're really about creating small voxels, right? So my co-founder, Ruel, was very inspired by IKEA.
Okay. Yeah.
And so so he put the two words together, sma, small furniture, and so Smörbla.
Smörbla, love it, love it. Well, Loretta, thank you. Yeah, no, that's fantastic. Thank you very much for your time. What can you tell us then for the listeners who might not know about your career and your route to Smörbla Studios?
Well, where should I start? How much time have you got?
as long as you need.
So, born and raised in Singapore, did grad school in London, as we're speaking, and then UCLA, and always thought I'd be a professor. But as luck would have it, life would have it, my dad had cancer, went back to Singapore to run a creative agency. My whole family is in the creative arts and media.
Okay.
So when I went back to Singapore, I ran the Activation Group, which is a end-to-end design agency. We design, we build, we create. If it sounds familiar, hey, it is. And yep. So then during the time, I had interesting clients like Samsung, Louis Vuitton, Nike, Adidas. But I also always found time to write, and I always found time to direct the theater. So I love the live interaction. And the other thing that I found a time to do was always be a social advocate. You know, I championed LGBTQIA rights. I was a grassroots leader. I was nominated as a member of parliament. So there are all these things that I did as well. Fast forward to going to Bhutan. I spent a lot of time in Bhutan as a consultant for the government of Bhutan. And then felt like, at some point in my life, I really wanted to go back to nature. And so I did. When I turned 40, I, upped and just left and moved to Hawaii. That was 2015, thinking that I'll now have a fairly quiet life in Hawaii. And so I started teaching in a university. And then fast forward to over COVID, I founded Smörbla Studios. And here I am now in 2023, and I'm pounding the streets, like you say, working 18 hours a day at the very least. And becoming an entrepreneur again, I feel like a geriatric mom, but super exciting space. So in short, done everything from being an academic, an author, a creative director, a theater director, a radio DJ, and now I'm having the time of my life, putting all my skill sets together and running Smörbla.
I follow you on social media, and I know for a fact that you work a lot longer than 18 hours a day. I'm thinking more 25 hours a day. But anyway, we'll get on to that.
And you're actually right, Tom. And in fact, I don't even post on social media because I have no time.
Exactly. There you go. On your website, Loretta, it says that you're a metaverse architecture and Web3 design agency. What attracted you to sort of get into this space?
You know, I have to say that it, at the start, it was really because I've always told the story, and there's a very human element to that. My co-founder, Ruel, who used to work for me in the Activation Group, he lost his job over COVID, and he has an autistic son. You know, he's a fairly young father, and, he was in Calgary in Canada. And first off, why are you in Calgary? Get out of Calgary. There's nothing there. But so he was there, and he reached out and he said he's lost his job. And at the point in time, there was no vaccines. We couldn't see the light at the end of the tunnel. And he said, do you have jobs for me? And so I do have these, odd jobs that I was giving to him. And so we're chatting. And by that time, he's an architect by trade, and he's a gamer. And he stumbled on the sandbox metaverse. And he said, hey, shall we put in something for the Game Makers Fund? And so I read about the ethos of the sandbox. And again, I started to get to know a little bit more about Sebastian, the founder, about what they're trying to do, about the creator economy, digitization of assets, asset creation. And I found that to be something that I was very drawn to, because remember, when I answered your question, I was and still am, first and foremost, always a creator, an educator, entrepreneur, a social advocate at heart. So when I see a space that could potentially bring people together, bring communities together, potentially create revenue streams, financial streams, a better way of being for creators that erstwhile have not been able to monetize on the artistry or creations because there's so many middlemen, you know, that are in the way of their art, right? There's no way for them to take their art direct to consumers because of all these powers that be. And then also around that time, by this time, we've heard of Cambridge Analytica. There is greater distrust in centralized institutions. So all these things added up made me realize that this is a really viable future. And how many times in life do you get a chance to actually sit at the front row and say, you know what, I think I'm onto something. We're not just riding on a fad, but we're driving the future of a phenomenon, a generation, and the democratization of power, the digitization of data, privacy, assets was something that really mattered to me. And when we got into space, it was the bull market. So we saw how we could change lives because Ruel got out of financial funk from what we were building. We're now able to scale from 2 to 40 folks. It's not a fad because we have our staff who have been able to climb up the social mobility ladder, buy bigger homes. So we know we're onto something, that this is potentially a creator economy that provides jobs. And this is why I still am in it, because I truly believe in trying to make people's lives better. So that's why I'm in it. I continue to believe in it. And I'm very thankful for opportunities like this and for partners like you and Forge to build this space together.
No, absolutely. And it's great to hear how passionate you are about the space, Loretta. It really is. Can you tell us about some of the projects Smurbra have been part of, or perhaps some of the things we might have heard of before?
Yeah, and I think you're absolutely right. I think what has always propelled me into all the things that I do was that it has to be come from a place of purpose. I've always said my tagline is people, purpose, possibilities, and really put I really take that to heart. So when we first started Smurbla, I was very clear that I didn't just want us to be flash in a pan, another hype NFT project. So I say at the core of us would be our core values, or what I call Smurbla ideals: inclusion, diversity, equity, access, leadership, love, sustainability. And we take that very seriously. Even our hiring policies, we hire across the gender, sexuality, racial spectrum. We hire folks from all around the world. So I think even the projects that we are based it around an initiative that we thought of, or that I created, called Metaverse for Good, because I genuinely believe, and it's not about being Pollyanna, like if we have the ability to co-create the future, I want to be able to co-create a better space. So we want to create a space where we can bring brands, IPs, and communities in to do good. So by that same token, you know, when I first came out and said that, I almost thought, am I shooting myself in the foot? But I was very certain I wanted to make a difference. So when I said we don't want to come up and do like violent games, or because I don't want to propel that sort of a narrative. So if we're going to be creating experiences, I wanted it to be something that people could really see themselves thriving in. So by that same token, we have actually created Tools of Rock, which was a concert venue, because we started thinking, what's going to happen to artists over the pandemic? So Tools of Rock was our first concert venue that we created. And then later on, we created Cobbleland, and Cobbleland is our own IP from the Game Makers Fund. And basically, Cobbleland is meant to be a world expo. And our idea was to bring, you know, LGBTQIA, BIPOC, mompreneurs, solopreneurs, typically folks who may feel lost in the real world because they're either priced out and can't buy real world estate. And now we're able to offer them entrance into the metaverse. We'll handhold them at lower cost coming into the metaverse. So that was Cobbleland. And then that graduated into us building up experiences like we created a digital wedding. Sebastian was the officiator of the wedding. So there was a real world wedding that was held in Singapore, and we also created a metaverse wedding. And we were able to create like the dream wedding of the bride, because she wanted it to be in a colonial estate with a disco hall, which would be cost prohibitive in the real world. So the other thing that we want to tell people is that the metaverse, it does not just have to be a digital twin, but it can be a fun, playful space where your dreams can come true. So, you know, we were able to make, you know, the bride and groom's dreams come true with a digital and metaverse wedding. We've also gone on to explore things like, right now we're building up Everest, and it is to celebrate the 70th anniversary of the first ascent by Sir Edmund Hillary. And we don't just want to build another climbing game, but again, we imbue our Metaverse for Good initiatives. So we talk about the Sherpa people, we talk about climate change, we talk about environmental conservation, all the while making it into a fun, engaging game, but we always want to make sure that we steer clear, or we stay true to our Smurbler purpose, which is that we always want to create something worthwhile, meaningful, engaging, educational, and fun at the same time, and a metaverse for good, and a whole host of other projects. Over the World Cup, as you will know, we also brought Nima, Son, and Figo into the space. So lots of really exciting projects. And right now, if you just allow me, just one more project. Over International Women's Day, we crafted a pilot project called Herstory, because we feel like women should make Herstory. Yeah. So we go around schools to teach girls in schools how to voxel, because our hopes is if girls know how to voxel, they then understand digital asset creation. If they understand digital asset creation, we can then teach them to understand what ownership means. And if you understand ownership, hopefully you begin to understand or get interested in financial literacy and entrepreneurship. And hopefully, you know, we're going to be teaching a generation of girls and young women, you know, that digital ownership can be a real tool towards financial independence. So that's the kind of projects that we have at Smurbler alongside a lot more.
When we discuss building in the metaverse then, Loretta, how does that work? Talk me through it, I guess, like I'm, I don't know, just past toddler age. Can you build whatever you want, as big as you want? Can I build a statue of yourself or me, for example?
You know, I feel like the five-year-old. I feel like, Tom, you know so much more than me. But again, I think what I want to do is also to sort of break it down to, I think right now when we talk about the metaverse, I think people get really confused about the word, but it really is a composite of like all these technologies that we already have, we've seen evolving, right? So the metaverse is really the AR component, the VR component. There's also the open metaverses, the closed metaverses. The closed metaverses meaning folks like Meta, right, they're building out their Oculus and their worlds. But the ones that we're very active in, we meaning at Forge and at Smurbler, we're really looking at building out the open metaverse. So if we used a platform like Sandbox, for example, you can technically, yes, build up anything and everything that you want, right? Because it does allow you the creativity, the tools to build out fun spaces. So we've built out anything from a concert venue, like I said, to a wedding venue, to a fairy tale venue, to we're building out Everest. So for some metaverses like Sandbox, there are land limitations, like 1x1 or 2x2 or 3x3, for example. But in some other metaverses that, you know, that we know, there are like no land limitations and you could potentially just build out as much as you want. But for me, because I fundamentally believe that one of the powers of the open metaverse is ownership. Hence, if ownership can drive creator value, then one of the reasons why I was drawn to the Sandbox was because there was land scarcity. Because fundamentally what drives value is scarcity.
Yes.
So while this is a digital space, and technically there are, I know other platforms that says we have unlimited land and unlimited infinite amount of digital space for you to create. I actually like the fact that there is a finite number of lands that you can build in, because again, it goes back to that's how we can generate value and generate more economic opportunity for creators that want to build on the space. So to your point, creatively, in terms of creativity, it's limitless, right? You could build against gravity and build to your fantasy. But in terms of economic value, I value platforms like the Sandbox, for example, because the scarcity drives value. So I hope that answers your question.
Yeah, no, that's brilliant. You've talked about some of the projects there and some of the sort of successful cases, if you like. What about some of the challenges you face in your role as CEO of a metaverse company?
Let's take it from a macro point of view first. I think macro, you will know as well as I do, anyone that, I mean, I think unless you've been hiding under a cave or a rock, everyone knows that we are in a bear market. And I think the bear market itself, first off, as an entrepreneur, you have to have copious amounts of optimism, right? Mm-hmm. So while I'm not a Pollyanna, I'm fully aware of what the climate is. I also truly believe that the bear market allows us to build, and for serious builders to build better, faster, better. Mm-hmm. But one of the things, the challenges that we have against us is that in any new environment, there's always going to be bad actors. And we don't have to say this again, but we've heard, you know, of FTX, we've heard of some bad actors in the space that have really crushed the confidence, lots of rug pull projects. So I do think that what we have to fight is some stigmas, bad associations,
Yeah.
bad actors, and just a series of experiences that have led the public to lose faith in the space. However, if we break it down on its own, to me, technology on its own is neutral. It will always move at a steady beat, whether or not you like it. Even if you had protested against having a smartphone. I mean, look at all of us today. Aren't we all addicted to our phones?
Absolutely.
I mean, back in the day in the 70s, it's like, we're fine with an analog phone. And it's like, why would I need a flip phone? Then why will I need a smartphone? And then why would I need an app? And here we are today. So I do think that these are evolutionary changes that will happen whether or not we want to be part of it. So the challenges include, obviously, market sentiments, but also lack of awareness. And lack of awareness always leads to fear, leads to speculation. So again, all of these challenges are that shouldn't face any entrepreneur, right? Most of us, we come into space because we're kind of suckers and sticklers for pain. We kind of know what we're in for. So again, I often like to see challenges as opportunities. But as a CEO of a company, obviously, part of it is attracting good talent, because when you're a small startup, we can't attract top talent because they may say, hey, where's the money, right? But as a small company, what we can offer is equity. What we can offer is a chance to play, a chance to be a pioneer in the space. So we do need to be able to get the word out there, to get good people, attract good people with great character. Because I always think that competency can be learned over time, but we need great people with great curiosity and character to lean in. And sometimes it's either they're attracted by the money, or they don't know about the opportunity. So we need to find that sweet spot where we find folks that are not just in it for the money. I know that's important, but we also need to find folks that have the gumption, the aptitude to want to come in. So talent is always, attracting the right talent is always a challenge. And the other is also, because we're so new in the space, there aren't any rule books. So we need to figure a lot of stuff out. We need to figure out IP rights. We need to figure out how do we create procedures and policies which make it open and yet safe. It sounds easy, but it's not always easy, because it's just like a democracy. If everything is open and democratized, then where do we draw those lines, right? The same fundamental questions that we ask in a democracy, we ask in an open metaverse. So these sorts of things. And I'll say the other challenge is obviously recognizing that there's going to be more and more competition. That's me now speaking as the founder of Smurbler. There's going to be more and more competition coming up. How do we remain competitive? How do we want to remain, you know, best in show and continue to do great work? So that would be some of the challenges that we face. But it doesn't faze me. We'll bring it on and take it on with some humility and head on with humility and sense of humor.
Yeah. You mentioned the stigma there. That's interesting. Why does the metaverse get so much sort of negative attention than you'd think?
I think fear. You know, I think fear. And if you just look into media, the fact is, if you have a peaceful day, that's not going to make the news. But if, you know, an FTX day, that's going to make the news. You have SVB bank run, that's going to make the news. And I think in today's 24/7 news cycle as well, things get proliferated again and again and again. And when I was growing up, there's only, especially in Singapore, there's only one national TV, right? There was one national newspaper.
Right.
You only have access to the media maybe once or twice a day and from one channel. Today, you have proliferation of different channels. Every single person today is potentially a media platform or media channel, right? We get to tweet, like you said, you follow me on social media, so we get to tweet, we get to retweet. So I think in today's day and age, we know this, fake news gets a lot of attention, it gets circulated again and again and again. We also see that, forgive me for saying this, but, you know, and I remember talking to one of the journalists before in one of our leading newspapers. And he or she told me that there are four things that makes the news, right? Blood, babies, boobs, and balls. And the other thing is, and I mean the soccer ball, like football, but also ball. But also bad news, right? So I think bad news sticks around for a lot more. And I think the reason why the metaverse gets so much negative attention to, besides the fact of the fear factor, the lack of awareness and the ignorance factor. It's because everyone likes to have an opinion. Everyone likes to sound smarter than the next person.
Yeah.
And we all want to sort of contribute to this because it's like, oh, I know it better, so let me have my word. And so I think it constantly gets circulated nonstop ad nauseum. And so, which is really important why, you know, whenever I get an opportunity to speak, for example, to you or to the mass media, mm-hmm. I often always say yes, because I think it's really important to have responsible players, partners in the space to really speak up and offer a different point of view. It may not be as sexy, because saying anything sane and sound is not sexy, right? Saying something ridiculous like Donald Trump, like, don't get me wrong, I do not like the guy, but Donald Trump gets so much airtime because he just goes off on a tangent, and it's like people like that. It's so tweetable. It's so fun to listen to. But sometimes when you're making, you know, sense, it's boring. It's not as fun. But I think it's really important to do that and get the facts out there and get it straight to the people.
How do you think Web3 and the metaverse can have more female representation then?
Having wonderful folks like you that says, hey, let's get Loretta on the show. We want to hear her voice. We want to have more women on the show. I think that's really important. You know, representation matters. I think the more we see it, the more normalizing.
But just on that there, Loretta, sorry to interrupt. You work for it though, as you say. We mentioned your hours, we had a bit of a laugh about it, but that is genuinely what you do. You work very hard at it. And I've seen, obviously, on social media the last couple of weeks, you've been in various different countries. I think with Hillary Clinton, there was an event there. So you are doing your bit, aren't you?
I absolutely am. I think, you know, first off, kudos to my family for having raised me as, you know, a kick-ass girl that says, you know, they literally tell me you be anything and everything that you want. Mm-hmm. And I truly believe that we do need to raise a generation full of really confident women. I mean, just children, you know, boys or girls, we just need to raise confident children. But since you are specifically on women, I'm speaking as an Asian woman talking to you, even though you can't see my face. Mm-hmm. But I think it's so important to, I mean, we talk about diversity, equity, inclusion, but we really do need to put words to action. These are not just talk, but it's so important to be able to go there and see a female technopreneur, to see a female role model. I mean, some people may say, hey, you know, but women have all these opportunities already. But you know, if you really looked into the figures, that's not true. We all know that, you know, it's only a fraction, like 2% of VC funds go to women. If you looked into the number of CEOs in, you know, Fortune 500 companies, it's just single digits, right? So I think we have a long way to go. Has there been progress? Yes, there has been progress, but I definitely think that we can definitely do more. So one of the things that I do, I shared with you earlier, is that we ensure that we actually hire more women. Actually, people have said, oh my God, Smallbox Studios is run by like power women. Do I consciously make the effort? Yes, I do. Is it difficult? Yes, it is, you know, but I do think that it's important, because, you know, it's so much easier to say, let me just go hire that Harvard grad, that frat boy who's super smart, is, you know, they can do all of this stuff. But it is that much harder to go find that one girl who's hiding in the corner, who's super smart in engineering and wants to, you know. Do you need to make an effort? Yes, you do. I've also hired stay-at-home moms. Is there a challenge? Yes, because some of them are like, oh no, can I really do this? I'm like, look, if you can raise a family, yes, you can work, you know, you can definitely be in my company, and you can, if you can run the household, you can definitely be here. Brilliant. But the thing is just also getting people to see that, really wanting to invest time in that.
Yeah.
And it really inspires, because I will tell you right now, even when I still go to tech conferences, that's one of the best thing about going to tech conferences is that I don't have to line for the bathroom. I laugh about it. That's a really good thing. But if you really looked at it, it's also kind of sad, because it's true. Like, I could roll around the bathrooms because I'm like one of two women in the bathrooms. You know, that's right. It's still a sausage fest. It's still largely full of boys and men. And so we can definitely do more. And how to make that happen, like I said, have more platforms, have more women who are already in the space speak up, to not be afraid, and have more of us empower others. I have also seen women who are in this space who are really competitive and they want to put down other women because they feel like, oh, we have very limited opportunities, so we want to put other women down. But I'm like, no. Because there's so few of us, all the more we should raise each other up and have us all come in and create even more opportunities. And so far, I have to say, it's been an incredibly inclusive space. Most of the women I've met are really like inclusive. They're like, we got to do this together. as with all things, there are always one or two bad actors, but again, you know, that's not gonna deter our collective need and want to bring more women and just diversity into the space in general.
What's the best way to convert, do you think, the mainstream to the metaverse, Loretta?
I think a few things. I think one is to have very credible brands, IPs, and communities come into the space. So one of the things that Smuggler did very, very intentionally, and why we're still here today, especially in a bull market, it doesn't seem very sexy because we are courting brands like, you know, DBS or telcos, like in Singapore, like StarHub, or, you know, well-known F&B chains. Like, they don't seem very sexy. Like, you, everyone wanted like the hype brand, right? Like an ape or a kitty or a doggy. But we were very intentional in knowing that because we're in a new space and we're a fairly small company, we needed to get the buy-in of big brands or IPs with strong communities to come in, because with their clout, they then lend credibility into the space. So I think that's one. The other is to also ensure that we try to be as good and as fair as we can be. So it's really important to have speakers and founders, like you said, like Sebastian will come on and speak, or I will come on and speak, or Yat will come on and speak. Like, it's really important to have credible founders who have substance, who speak eloquently, not to say I'm very eloquent at 9 p.m. at night, but who can speak authentically, and they're not just there for hype. So I think there's that. And I also think the other thing is, at least for us at Smuggler, we try to create utility to the project and create links to real-life projects. That's our USP. Why do I say that? Because then it allows people to not just think of the metaverse as NFTs. I think there is that simple conflation that, oh, crypto equals NFTs equals metaverse. Like, it's a very simplistic reduction right now. But if we created opportunities for folks to see. So, for example, I'll just give you an example. We worked with the food bank, one of the first projects we brought to the metaverse. So, yes, there is a digital collectible component where we design the digital collectible, or NFT. Digital collectible is just a better word now, where we design the digital collectible. But we also ensured that we linked it to real-world utility. So the NFTs, for example, enabled you to maybe access something in the food bank. So the food bank actually has these vending machines that dispenses hot food all around Singapore. So we'll approach a brand like, for example, Forge, and we'll say, hey, Forge, would you purchase this NFT? And you say yes. And so what we'll do is we'll actually skin, or we'll go around all the vending machines in Singapore, and we'll skin it with your Forge branding. So it becomes something that brands understand, like, ah, there is real-world utility to that. I mean, that is just an example. Of course, there's various kinds of utilities that we can work out, but that's one example that by creating real-world links, people can then, aha, understand that. We also then create, like what I told you, we create workshops, we create awareness, we create panels, we create a lot of links to IRL activities, because then I think it brings it home. It's not so abstract, especially in a post-COVID world where people were all going out again and socializing. We felt like those links bring home the metaverse a little bit more, because we're not saying that the metaverse is going to overtake IRL, which is the fear that most people have. They're like, oh no, we can't do that. But it's to say it is to augment your real-world activities. It is another layer too, and we are already living that. So we get people to kind of see that and embrace it in a less fearful way. And I think finally, it's always about education, 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 engagement, 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 to get more people listening, engaged, endeared into the space. And that's really how we get more conversion.
It's been really great to have you on, Loretta. And we always like to end the podcast with a prediction question, and really just so that we can get you back on to discuss it later on in a few months' time. But we'll ask you the same as what we ask everybody else. And the question today for you is, what do you think will happen in the metaverse space in the next 12 to 18 months? And I know that's quite a wide-ranging and vast ask from you.
And I think it's such a crystal ball. So what I will see, I mean, I think now you're seeing news that a lot of the closed metaverses, your metas and the like, they are beginning to shut down. You see like news of like Disney trying to sort of reverse its metaverse policies. I think you're beginning to see your centralized metaverses becoming a little bit more conservative because of market sentiments. But I don't see that happening in our Web3 open metaverse players. I think if anything, a lot of us that are in the space who are serious builders are doubling down and building harder and faster in this space. If you look into the sandbox, for example, like Sebastian is all over the globe. Like I'm going around and we're building more. So I will say that I think the serious players are going to double down and use this opportunity to build more networks, to go out and meet more partners, because in a bull market, everyone is just like out there. In a bear market as we are, I think we're going to see more steady builds. It may not be as hype and as loud, but I think that beat is going on. And I also think that serious players, and I can tell you that because we've been busier than ever, because serious players sense opportunity, right? In the bear market, there's always opportunity. Things are cheaper. It's like a fire sale almost for many. So serious players who sense opportunity, who know that this is not going away, are actually investing more in the space. You just don't see it because it's quieter, but it doesn't mean things are not happening. In fact, if anything, it's weeded out a lot of the speculators and the bad actors. So what I think we will see in the next 12 to 18 months is you may not see as much media attention and hype, but what you will see coming out of the 12 to 18 months is that you're going to see a lot of really strong projects, builders who have been steadily building really begin to emerge from this sort of like abyss, you know. But it is happening, I assure you. We're busier than ever. You just may not hear us as loudly as before, but we're here for sure, and we're here to stay.
Loretta, it's been brilliant to have you on. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you so much, Tom. Such a pleasure. And I definitely hope I'll be back before the 12 to 18 month period.
We hope so too, Loretta. Thanks again. And a huge thank you as well to you, the listener. We look forward to seeing you next time for the latest episode of You, Me, and Web3. Until then.